Right now on The Daily Debrief, Eric Boyd on trial for the brutal rape and murder of a college couple. His co-defendant takes the stand and says Boyd lit one of the victims on fire.
I seen a bright whoosh.
Can the state's star witness hold together under intense pressure of cross-examination?
Isn't it true that you decided to blame Eric Boyd for the crimes that you committed?
And closing arguments in the Hollywood Ripper serial killer trial, the defense says Ashton Kutcher's testimony shows there's an alternate suspect.
I believe Ashton Kutcher is the star witness in this case. I'm going to see why.
Plus, prosecutors are trying to put a stop to leaks to the media in the case about the missing Connecticut mom. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Thursday, August 8th.
And good evening, everyone. This is The Daily Debrief. I'm Rachel Stockman in for Aaron Keller alongside Brian Buckmeyer this evening. We have a lot to cover. Today, contentious cross-examination of the prosecution's key witness in the trial of a Tennessee man accused of brutally murdering a college couple. Eric Boyd faces life in prison if convicted in the deaths of 21-year-old Shannon Christian and 23-year-old Christopher Newsom. Both victims were allegedly beaten, raped, and murdered. Newsom was shot three times, then doused in gasoline and set on fire. Christian is believed to have been held captive for 24 hours, repeatedly sexually assaulted, then stuffed in a trash can. Boyd claims he wasn't involved with these vicious murders. Four other co-defendants have already been convicted in the case, with sentences ranging from the death penalty to 35 years in prison. The co-defendant, George Thomas, took the stand today against Boyd in exchange for his two life sentences being reduced to 50 years. Now, before we get to that contentious cross, in graphic testimony yesterday, Thomas pointed the finger at Boyd for the death of victim Christopher Newsom and made himself out to be a passive observer in the entire gruesome event.
What did you see Mr. Boyd do?
He got out of the SUV and opened the back door, grabbed Mr. Newsom, and they walked towards the drainage ditch area.
What are you doing?
I'm sitting beside the front seat, just looking.
What happens after that?
Kind of pulled him over towards that way, well, walked him over that way. Then I seen three light, bright, you know, shots, basically.
So when you saw the three flashes, who did you see pulling Mr. Newsom?
Mr. Boyd.
What happened after he pulled Mr. Newsom to that location?
Now he came back and grabbed the can of gas.
Who did that?
Mr. Boyd.
So what happens after you see him get the gas?
He goes back towards the area where he had pulled Mr. Newsom, and that's when, a couple of minutes later, I seen a bright whoosh.
Then Thomas says Boyd left him in a white Pontiac. This is the car Boyd's cousin testified in other trials that she had let him borrow. But now, in this trial against her cousin, she doesn't remember. We're going to play you what Thomas said, then the cousin's testimony from earlier in this trial.
Mr. Boyd leaves.
Now, how does he leave?
He left inside his car.
Can you describe his car for us?
It was a white Pontiac.
As you sit here today, do you recall whether or not you loaned your white car to Mr. Boyd the first weekend of January 2007?
I do not recall.
You have to say into the mic.
I do not recall.
Okay. So, of course, you recall testifying previously at previous proceedings?
Yes.
Do you recall being asked this, did you find anything else in the car? And you recall answering, yes, a sandwich bag of bullets.
No,
you recall giving that answer?
No.
On cross-examination, the defense first accused Thomas of scheming with his best friend, co-defendant Neltavis Cobbins, to put the blame on Eric Boyd.
And again, would you call him your best friend?
I mean, at the point in time, yeah.
Yeah, so that was your best friend. Mr. Thomas, isn't it true that you and Neltavis Cobbins decided to blame Eric Boyd for the crimes that you committed?
No.
You didn't plan that when you got back to Kentucky?
No, we did not.
You blamed Eric Boyd, right? You're blaming him.
I didn't blame him.
Mr. Thomas, you didn't care what happened to Eric Boyd.
Oh, you asked me did I care what happened to him?
I'm saying you didn't care, did you?
I didn't know him, so.
You didn't know? Okay. Just like you didn't care what happened to Shannon Christian.
I don't see how those two would relate to say that I didn't care about them. I mean, I didn't know them either.
Yeah. Just like when you said, fuck that white girl. She didn't mean anything to me. You said that, didn't you?
I didn't say that specifically like that. That statement was taken out of context by Detective Norman.
Then the defense went after Thomas's story on witnessing the defendant kill Christopher Newsom, who Thomas says has changed multiple times.
Testified yesterday that Chris Newsom wasn't taken off by Eric Boyd and LaMarcus Davison, which is at least one of the statements that you made in Kentucky, right?
Correct.
I think you also said in Kentucky that Eric Boyd took Mr. Newsom off by himself, correct?
Correct.
Yesterday you testified that in fact you and Eric Boyd took Mr. Newsom off.
Correct.
And finally, the defense made sure the jury was reminded about the deal Thomas is getting for testifying.
When all of this went back down in 2007 and you were charged, state of Tennessee went for the death penalty, right?
Against Correct.
You. And you got life without parole.
Correct.
And they went after you a second time in a retrial, right?
Correct.
And you came out of that with two consecutive life sentences, right?
Correct.
Plus 25 years.
Correct.
And now they're offering you 50 years.
Correct.
And you've done served more than 10 of that.
Correct.
So you've basically gone from spending the rest of your life in prison to one day you're going to get out, potentially.
Possibly.
All right, a lot to break down here. I'm joined now by public defender and law and crime host Brian Buckmeyer and attorney Michael Troyanis, who joins me via Skype. So nice to have you gentlemen on the program this evening. Okay, this Thomas witness, fascinating, the prosecution's key witness and the key that they are trying to use to convict Boyd of those murder charges. Michael, I'll take it to you first. How did he fare under cross-examination?
He came off a little combative for my taste, as far as if I'm sitting in the position of being the prosecutor. And additionally, he completely tried to devoid himself of any blame, regardless of the fact that he was already found guilty for the crimes associated with this case.
Brian Buckmeyer, was his testimony, I know you were listening to a lot of it, was it believable?
I don't find it all that believable. I also didn't find it all that pointed. If they're really trying to say this is the key to lock away Eric Boyd, I don't think it quite fit the lock. I think it was missing a lot of fundamental components, and then ending it with him being a truly interested witness was a very good way to finish off that cross-examination.
Okay, let's talk about why it took him so long then. All these years later, when here he is 10 years already into serving a lifetime sentence, and then he decides to flip on this guy, Eric Boyd. It raises suspicions, Brian, right?
It does. I mean, it seems like he's only really testifying because a great opportunity is coming for him. And by reality, I mean, it's not just a turn of phrase. He is fighting for his life. He's fighting for the hope to one day be able to walk out of jail. He never said this to anyone prior to this deal. So again, it raises question as to, is this truthful?
Exactly. Okay, let's get to some more testimony in this case. After George Thomas stepped down, the mother of both of the victims took the stand. First was Mary Newsom, the mother of Chris Newsom.
When he came down the steps that night, that was the last time I saw him. And before he left, I said, Chris, I think you should get something to eat. And he said, no. He said, I'm taking Shannon out to eat, and then we're going to a party over at Jamie's house. The next day, when we got a phone call from Shannon's mother, and Shannon hadn't showed up at work, that started a panic at our house. We didn't hear anything until the next morning, and that's when Snodderly came over, and the chaplain came over, and someone else, and told us that the body that they had found on the railroad tracks was Grace. And after that, I just kind of lost it and didn't remember much of anything for the next 2 weeks.
Next, Shannon Christian's mother spoke about her experience when her daughter was missing, then found dead.
I think when we found out that the body on the railroad tracks was Chris's, I knew it was not going to be good for us either, but we just kept looking. And when they identified Chris's body is when KPD, Knox County, I mean, I think we had ATF, we had U.S. Marshals, we had everybody. They ended up down on the railroad tracks. Sheriff Hutchinson had set up a command post at a little restaurant right there on Cherry Street, and that's pretty much where we stayed.
Is that where you were when you found out Shannon had been found?
Yes, sir.
Did you learn the circumstances at that time, or was it?
At that time, no, I don't believe that I did. I just, you know, they said they'd found her and she was deceased, and then all of them were screaming. And...
All right, let's bring back our panel to discuss these mothers' testimony. Obviously, so heartbreaking to hear them. The panic that they must have felt trying to figure out what had happened to their children. But Michael, does that matter in terms of convicting Eric Boyd?
Well, in the grand scheme of things, you would hope, being on the defense side of the table, that the jury is going to remove any and all emotion and stick to the facts, the law, the evidence, and make a decision on whether or not the case has been proven beyond all reasonable doubt. But in reality, jurors are people just like you and I, and when they go back into that jury deliberation room, they're going to bring in their life experiences and the emotions and the things that were said during that trial. So I think that although evidentiary concerns regarding what was stated aren't going to rue the day, but the fact that the heartstrings of these jurors were pulled by seeing the mothers of these innocent victims is going to be something that's quite compelling.
And Brian Buckmeyer, I keep going back to this in this case, and a lot of us here at Long Crime keep going back to this. This is such a brutal crime. All of these people took part in raping, torturing, this couple that seemed to have, didn't random, they were completely random. What is the motive? And have, by listening to the trial so far, have you been able to understand what could have possibly motivated them to do this? I know it started off as a carjacking, but...
I think this is a senseless crime, and I think as a defense attorney, we often don't use the word victim unless it is truly appropriate. And I think this is where you have to kind of say, hey, there is a victim in this case.
Right.
And that is our victim, sorry. It is both of these two individuals, but you also have to pose it and say, we don't want a third victim, and that's my client who wasn't actually there. So you have to absorb and say, hey, these parents are absolutely victims in this. This is a senseless crime, but let's not add to that by putting on my client who didn't participate in this.
Well, certainly this is an interesting one because there's not a whole lot of direct evidence tying Eric Boyd to this. So we'll see what happens and what the jurors decide. Still ahead tonight, though, on the Daily Debrief, a media gag order is requested in the case of a missing Connecticut woman whose husband faces charges in her disappearance. And in closing arguments in the Hollywood Ripper trial, find out how Ashton Kutcher and amnesia figured into the defense's closing argument when we return. Prosecutors in the case of a missing Connecticut mother are trying to stop her husband's attorney from speaking to the media. The prosecutor is asking a judge for a gag order in the case of Fotis Doulos to prevent lawyers from making prejudicial statements in public settings. Fotis Doulos and his girlfriend pleaded not guilty to tampering with evidence and hindering prosecution. His wife, Jennifer, has been missing since May 24th. Police say the suspect here was last seen dumping trash bags on the night of Jennifer's disappearance. He's scheduled to appear in court tomorrow. Two Canadian teenage murder suspects were found dead, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police announced. The bodies of Cam McLeod and Briar Schmigelski were reportedly recovered on a bank of a river in northern Canada after a weeks-long manhunt. The suspects are believed to have killed 64-year-old University of British Columbia lecturer Leonard Dick, 24-year-old North Carolina resident China Deese, and her 23-year-old Australian boyfriend. Police say they hope the recovery of the suspects' bodies would calm residents, many of whom have been afraid to leave their homes. Day three of closing arguments in the case against the so-called Hollywood Ripper. Right now, the prosecution is giving their rebuttal arguments, and it won't be long before the case is in the jurors' hands. Michael Gargiulo is facing two murder charges in the stabbing deaths of Ashley Ellerin and Maria Bruno, and one attempted murder charge for allegedly stabbing Michelle Murphy. All of these occurred between 2001 and 2008. He's also accused of killing an 18-year-old woman outside of a Chicago residence, where he will stand trial after the California case concludes. The prosecution emphasized the similarity between all the victims and that of Michael Gargiulo's noticed all of them.
Similarity number one that tells us the man who attacked these four women is the same man. The four victims in this case, it wasn't men, it wasn't children, it wasn't the elderly. It was four female victims, all young, attractive, and outgoing. Their characteristics are a common characteristic of the victims in this case. And don't forget, you have evidence that Michael Gargiulo was actually attracted and noticed these women. Michelle Murphy told you the man who drove the Gus the Plumber van would wave to her when she would see him. And as I told you a few moments ago, Mr. Gargiulo told his coworker that Michelle Murphy was hot and that he was going to get with her. Michael Gargiulo noticed Ashley Ellerin. He told his old friend, Mirko Hoffman, that the girl who got murdered in Hollywood was attractive. Anthony Castellani testified, every time Ashley Ellerin walked into the room, Gargiulo stopped talking to him, fixated on Ashley Ellerin, and followed her around the room with his eyes.
The defense sought to separate all these cases and create as much reasonable doubt as they could. Here in these next sound bites, like a Hollywood script, I kid you not, the defense says the murder of Ashley Ellerin may be part of some kind of jealous love triangle involving the actor Ashton Kutcher and the apartment manager. Take a listen.
I believe Ashton Kutcher is the star witness in this case, and we're going to see why. Ashley telling Mr. Kutcher, I just got out of the shower, 8:24. Todd Jackson saying, 8:25, 8:30, he hears two screams. Who do you think the next important witness is? Mark Durbin. And I'll tell you why. This guy, Mark Durbin, says he went over there about 7 p.m. with the intent to have sex. He says he was there for about an hour and a half before he left to go down to the Bonita Apartments. He says he was there when Ashley was showering, as I mentioned. He was there when she got the phone call, Mr. Kutcher. Well, you know what? He's also there when Todd Jackson hears the screams coming from the yellow house. Look at the time.
For the second victim in this case, Maria Bruno, the defense brought up another alternate suspect, her ex-husband. Take a listen.
Irving Bruno struck his wife for the 9 years that they were together. He called it striking. He said this striking went on for 9 years. The prosecution called Grace Urias. Who was she? She was the apartment manager of the 4626 Arden Way complex. She was the apartment manager of the apartment that Maria Bruno eventually moved in. Maria told her that she was going through a divorce. Maria told Ms. Urias that she was concerned about her husband.
But while they denied the defendant killed Ashley Ellerin and Maria Bruno, they admitted Gargiulo broke into Michelle Murphy's home and stabbed her. But they explained it like this. Take a listen.
Michelle Murphy is the only count in which the prosecution has shown that Mr. Gargiulo was in her apartment and attacked her. So why is this important? We look at the testimony of Michelle Murphy, who said, and I admit she went through a terrible experience. If we could make it not happen, we would have. But the bottom line is she says that she's fighting off Mr. Gargiulo when all of a sudden he cuts himself. He stands up. He like comes out of a fog. He stands up, looks around, says, I'm sorry, and runs out. This is an individual who just came to from a dissociative fugue. Didn't know where he was, didn't know what he was doing, has no recollection and no memory.
All right, I want to bring in my panelist, Michael Troiano. He joins me via Skype. Brian Buckmeyer here on set with me as well. Okay, I gotta say, I thought these defense closings were quite effective. They admitted to one of the attempted murder charge, basically involvement. But the other two, they made the point that there was no direct evidence linking the defendant to the scene of the crimes. Michael, what do you think?
Well, I believe when they got to the point where they were describing how two of the crimes that the prosecution could not actually put their client at the scene was highly effective. What I did kind of take a pause and almost, you know, shrieked at, if you will, is on the case, in the charge in which they admit that he was in the room and he, the argument that he was in a fog and a dissociated state. I mean, that makes me very fearful going back to the jury room and saying, is this the type of person we want out in the streets? And they might ignore the law and just say, we got to lock this guy up, if in fact that's even true, that he just goes into some sort of comatose state and attacks people.
Yeah, Brian, let's comment really quickly because we're about out of time. Was that an effective strategy to admit to the third victim?
I think it's effective in one sense, but ineffective in another. Kind of what Michael is saying. If this is truly who he is, they can color that personality with the rest of the cases and might assume that he did it at all. So that's kind of dangerous.
And they kind of had to because his DNA was in that case. So they have to admit to it. Okay, thank you both for joining us and all of our viewers for joining us tonight. Our live trial coverage resumes at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Stay with us. This is The Daily Debrief.